In 15 seconds, 7:30 p.m. BULOVA, Bulova Watch Time. See the 17 jewel.
Friday evening, and once again, the Federal Savings and Loan Associations of Massachusetts and New Hampshire bring you another dramatic human story by Alton Hall Blackington, New England's own master storyteller. The Federal Savings and Loan Associations bringing you Yankee Yarns are locally managed, federally chartered mutual thrift institutions. They are helping scores of thousands of families and individuals to get ahead faster through federally insured savings plans and low-cost monthly payment home financing programs. For savings, for home financing, remember the name Federal Savings. And now, with his copyrighted story about Indians in the war, here's Blackie.
Good evening. Ever since these Yankee Yarns started nearly 2 years ago, I have steered away from the war. Because I didn't have anything to add to what you see in the papers or hear on the radio, I felt there was plenty of other material that you would find interesting and worthwhile. Last Friday night, I did mention the first-class job the war correspondents are doing over there. And tonight, I have another slant on the invasion that I think is worthy of your attention. When I started to write this story, I didn't know that Bill Cunningham was doing the same thing for his column in the Boston Herald, and that Time magazine already had it in type. I don't expect to add anything to Bill's picturesque rendition, but I can add a few highlights to round out a picture that I hope Hollywood will someday preserve in Technicolor. In color and with sound, it ought to bring Buffalo Bill and Kit Carson right out of their graves with lusty cheers. Tonight I'm going to talk about one of my favorite subjects, Indians. Indians from the great Southwest, Apaches, Hopis, and Navajos, who are at this very moment fighting in France. I don't know how many American Indians there are in uniform, but there must be thousands. And although it's easy to understand how Sammy Sunsnake and Joseph Sweetpea could be rounded up to register for the draft when they rode in town, it must have taken a super salesman to get thousands to enlist voluntarily into a military service that is against all their principles and tribal customs. The Indians that I saw in Arizona and New Mexico were the most peaceful people you can imagine, quite content to watch their flocks grazing along the walls of colorful canyons, or to make pottery and turquoise trinkets in front of adobe houses on the edge of the desert. There wasn't a war whoop in the whole crowd. In fact, they seemed almost childlike in appearance and manner. The few bad habits they did have, so we were told, had been introduced by the pale faces from the east when they came riding roughshod over the prairies to oust the red men from their homelands so they could dig for gold and oil. There are some dark pages on our history books about all that unfortunate business, and the educated Indian of today will tell you with a sad shake of his head that they're still being pushed around by the Great White Father, which is their title for Uncle Sam or the government. It's only natural, then, that it came as a bit of a surprise to find that so many Indians are in the service. And the recent saga of the Wild 13 in Cunningham's column about the Indian paratroopers is one for the scrapbook. Navajos, as you may know, are nomads, roaming from place to place wherever green grass, clear water, and their fancy beckons. For houses, they have hogans, rude shelters made of logs or sod with a hole in the roof for the smoke to come out, and a single door that always faces the rising sun. No Navajo will enter a hogan that has a door facing north, south, or west. And that proved pretty costly to a Hollywood movie company, which built a whole village of hogans facing the setting sun. But all the doors had to be bricked up with adobe mud, new doors cut in the opposite side, before the Indian actors would go anywhere near them. So it's a mystery to me how the army got some of those Indians into barracks at all, considering how they prefer to sleep on the ground, with just the stars above them. One of the teachers at the government school near Keene's Canyon told me it was almost impossible to get the kids to stay in bed when they first showed up for school in September. I peeked in the morning, he said, and there wasn't a kid to be seen. Those little bright-eyed brats had lugged the beds outdoors and were sleeping under them. And feeding and discipline were other problems. For days, the children would sit behind their books like little graven images. And then when a hawk flew over, or the wind whistled in the stovepipe, or sometimes when nothing at all happened that the teacher could see, they were off like a flight of bats, out of sight, into the sagebrush. And after the evil spirits had gone,
they'd come back to school.
"We've about given up trying to feed them what they ought to have," the teacher said wearily. "All they seem to want is an old bone to chew on, just like a dog." How then? How then did they ever manage to get and hold hundreds of young Hopis and Navajos, free as the clouds that sailed over the plains and mesas, into steam-heated barracks and tight uniforms. Perhaps it is because, above all else, an Indian loves his freedom. Perhaps that is why young Johnny Laughing Water is willing to leave his turquoise trails to fight and maybe die in flaming foreign fields. Among the terrible 13 who made history during the dark dawn of D-Day, there was one young paleface from Brooklyn, New York. The Indians accepted him after he and one of the red men slipped their fingers and allowed their blood to mix. Then they called him Apache Brother, and he was one of the first to tumble out of the sky over France, loaded down with TNT and other explosives. These 13 Indian paratroopers who dropped into the fields before the invasion barges landed on the beach had only a few minutes to find their objectives and destroy them. They had about one chance in a million of coming out alive. The army officials in charge of these red devils were smart enough to let the Indians handle this tough assignment in their own way. They gave them whatever tools and weapons they wanted and even let them practice foraging, Indian fashion, on the closely guarded kitchens and warehouses. Why, there was a lot of excitement one night when it was found that somebody, right under the eyes of the guard, had sneaked up and swiped some nylon rope that was to be used for towing gliders. The Indians snitched the nylon because when it's unraveled, it makes a fine, strong noose for Nazi necks. It's lighter than the piano wire generally used for garroting and throat cutting. Well, for months, these Indian paratroopers lived in complete isolation. Not even their own officers could visit them. They conditioned themselves in their own way and probably practiced pagan rites as their dusky fathers had done before them. They lived in the open, sleeping on the good earth from which all life springs, under the uncovered sky, where in cloudy caverns the gods of wrath and fury dwell, where the demon drums of thunder roll and the arrows of lightning are forged. And while they waited and prayed and fasted, they forged with their nimble fingers their own primitive darts of death, long, sharp knives, thin as hatpins. And one big brave, according to the dispatch, spent hours sandpapering the points of a pair of brass knuckles till they sparkled, hard and sharp as the spines of a cactus. No army cook sampled the strange concoctions brewed over the tiny fires on that foggy English countryside. No questions were asked if a goat or chicken disappeared. No one winked or laughed if packages of herbs and plants were left at the barbed wire fence beyond which no white man might pass. Because, a few hours before the dawn of D-Day, ancient Aztec rites and the modern methods of war were mingling for the first time in the world's history. The lives of thousands of men depended on the terrible 13 who volunteered to spearhead the invasion from the sky. It was their task to fall on France as silently as a shadow, to cut wires, chop down trees, blow up bridges, and set signals, all in a matter of minutes. If the enemy interfered, he was to be struck down by methods not pleasant to contemplate. Few white men could survive the training of those red men. They might have to hide for weeks without food or water. So for weeks they fasted, just as the Navajos did in Arizona and New Mexico, when the shadow of the big bat, the evil omen of famine, flitted across the sun-baked floor of the canyon, warning that drought and death were just around the corner. Why, for 100 days, no cloud had appeared in the deep blue-black sky above the plains. Every green thing, including the corn, crinkled and died, even the fish in the steaming stream. But the hungry Indian lived on, and walking by night came at last to cooler and greener plains, where with hand upstretched to heaven, he gave thanks that he had fasted and gained strength for this ordeal. Fasting, the Indians say, dries up the surplus fat, leaving muscles like steel, but steel has to be tempered, you know. And so, just as the braves of olden days raced along the shimmering sands and scaled the hot high cliffs 1,000 years before the word commando was coined, the 13 Indian paratroopers practiced running and jumping with back-breaking loads to find out just how many spades and picks and shovels and guns they could deliver on D-Day. Instead of bows and arrows, they carried carbines and cartridges, fuse caps and flares, pistols with silencers, and razor-sharp machetes, charges of TNT and hand grenades. And a week before invasion time, they moved up close to the 9th Air Force Field and were assigned their parachutes, big, silky 24-footers, guaranteed to hold up 280 pounds. The Indians grinned, knowing full well that when loaded, they weighed close to 350 pounds apiece. When the officers told them to lighten their load for safety's sake, you know what they did? They wiped off some war paint and clipped off a little hair. Time magazine says that everybody at the airfield knew the Indians were coming long before they showed up. And this reminds me of a blistering hot day when I was in Arizona looking for Navajos. The wind changed, and we knew we were on the right track. This is no sly poke at those brave, primitive people who don't bother to bathe. If you had to trudge 5 miles across a hot, dusty desert to get a gourd full of water, you'd drink it as they do.